Tonight is a speaker meeting with Into Action. Please give a warm welcome to our speaker this evening, Thomas from the New Day Group.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you all very much for having this meeting. I came out a couple years ago with Ralph. Ralph kind of got this thing set up both years, and I just had a wonderful time a couple years ago. I came to maybe three or four of the speaker meetings, and I think you all sent out to our group, which is the New Day group, at least two or three speakers that I saw. And I just think that's the coolest thing in the world that this even happens. I think it's, Lyle mentioned that they do that up in Boston, and I think it's a great thing. It's like an exchange student, you know, meeting. And so I'm going to get into my story, but I feel very grateful to be here tonight. And I was in the car tonight driving, and I had in there, my sobriety date is December 9th, 2004, and I've known Chuck. Chuck is here, and I've known Chuck for all of those 21 years, and then I've known Ralph since Ralph came in. I'm Ralph's sponsor. I was sponsoring Ralph's sponsor initially, and Ralph's sponsor went out, and so I inherited Ralph. But it was one of the best things that happened to me. And I'm going to get to my story, but I love the whole thought that the best years of our life are ahead. And Ralph came in at age 68, and I think he's 82 or 3 now. He's had a blast. He has absolutely had a blast. He knows more people. He worked for the district, and so part of that was going out and visiting groups to find out who was maybe wanting to contribute some more, and he did that, and he just stayed in touch with all of those groups. And, I've got Robert, right, and he has been in the program, Ralph, I think 14 years?
14 years.
Okay, and then Robert has been in about, 14, maybe 15 years. And we love AA. We all do. And so I'll get into my story. And hopefully there'll be a message. But I grew up one of three sons. I was the middle child. Both of my parents are educators. They were not alcoholic. They were loving. I was brought up listening to my great grandmothers. I knew both of them. They were, one of them was born in 1894, and she lived until I was 21. Another of my great grandmothers was born in 1901. She was part Cherokee, and she lived until the year 2000. And on that side of my family, poor farmers that were so spiritual, so happy. They never drank, and that's my dad's side. And I loved all of them. They were veterans of wars and just the greatest people. And I just grew up listening to stories about how it used to be. And I loved it, and I was, very much in touch with that whole spirituality. And on my mom's side, they were wealthy, Southerners from Atlanta, very wealthy. That's where the alcohol happened. Okay, it happened. As a matter of fact, my grandmother on my mom's side, who I was very close to, she died when I was 8, and she died from alcoholism. And she would be one of these what they called it back then, periodics or spree drinkers. She was a absolute, you know, Southern lady, but if she drank, they found her three states away. And my mom said that she was completely different. And there were things, you know, we've all heard the stories about alcoholic parents chasing their kids around with knives and things like that. That's what she did. And then when you talked to her, when I knew her, I loved her very much. She took me up to walk up to the store when she visited one time, and we bought a little yo-yo. Yo-yos were big back then. And then I remember her bringing me back and showing me how they folded shirts in the big department stores. Just had a wonderful relationship with her. But that very night, I didn't know about it, I found out two men from AA brought her back to my parents' house, same house that night, and it was like 2 a.m. They found her passed out in the alley behind a place called Pussycat A Go-Go. You know, completely out of character. And I know people, there's women like that who I love, who are in my home group, who never get more than 6 months, who try their best to work the program, but they just don't really fully commit. And I see them come in and we see them die, you know, and we love them. It's not like we're upset with them at all. They just can't ever seem to get more than, you know, 3 to 6 months. At any rate, that's where I came from. Both my parents are educators. My dad was a psychology professor, and he did industrial psychology, though. It wasn't the clinical, and so he would do, he worked for NASA. They would do retinal studies where they'd follow a pilot's eyes during simulations so they could figure out where to put the instruments. That's the kind of stuff he did. So he definitely did not have the clinical side. So that none of that psychology that he had helped me. And my mom was a special education teacher. I'll tell you, my dad died in 2016. My mom, who is 86, she walks 10,000 steps a day. And I still go over there maybe 3 times a week and lay on her couch while she watches soap operas. I read a book. And I've done that since I was 15. And I had my two brothers. My oldest brother is in the program. He got sober in 1993. He lives in Florida. And if you have been to the New Day group, you know it's just a strip mall. And we are situated right in between a bar, which is only 10 feet away to this left. And then on the right, there's a church that used to be a B-Lo. And it used to be a thrift store right there. And they would keep our key for the meeting. And I'm going to jump around a little bit just to kind of give you an idea of they would keep our key, and also the bar would actually make our barbecue for our picnic every year. And it wouldn't put alcohol in it, so that was good. But my brother's home group is the same type of place in Florida. They have 40 or 50 meetings a week. On the ceiling tiles, when a home group member passes away, they'll take one of the blank tiles down and they'll put it on a table and people will sign it. And a lot of times what they'll do is they'll do a picture of someone will paint a picture of the home group member and they put it back up after a month. So when you walk in there, you have all the people in the meeting and then you look up and it's all your old home group members that have passed away on the ceiling. Pretty neat. And then I have a younger brother who is 6'8", and just the sweetest guy. And he never really got into alcohol. He did the marijuana maintenance for really about 40 years, and he had a bypass surgery, and that just kind of was his time to stop. So that's how it was set up. And I was, you know, just in a wonderful place growing up. And one of the things that happened to me, which is very important because it really has a lot to do with the amount of, I guess, mental angst and emotional trauma that I went through on my way to get into recovery. I was about 10 years old and I had my first panic attack. And it was the most unsettling, horrible things I've ever experienced. And if you have never had a panic attack, that's good. If you have had one, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But the feeling was as if I was going to die any second. It was going to be really bad, and I felt as though there was no space, there was nothing solid in any direction, and I didn't know where the you know, the threat was coming from, but I just felt impending doom any moment, and my heart was jumping out of my chest and I couldn't stop it. And it was horrible because it really taught me in a weird way that I'm not safe anywhere, because it came to me from inside of my head. Okay, it was not out there. It was not something I could run from. It was something that happened inside of my head and I couldn't run from it. And it was made known to me during that first one that it could happen at any time. As a matter of fact, my own thinking led to it initially. And it started out, there's probably some sort of imbalance, but I had like galloping thoughts of fear, and then that ran away with itself, and then it went into the panic attack. So it was devastating. My parents took me to see different doctors and psychologists and things like that, and they had they tried some different medicines, and I had them pretty frequently. But here's what the real crusher was, and this is very, very common with anxiety disorder. I was hyper vigilant at all times to try and see if I could keep my thinking from going to a panic attack. So that meant I was hypervigilant, checking in with myself every 2 or 3 minutes. Am I okay? Am I about to have a panic attack? What am I doing? And so forth. And that was constant. So it's called anticipatory anxiety, where that actually becomes the most devastating part of it, because you're so afraid of having it, you think that you need to be constantly dialed into what you're thinking. And so that was happening. And I'll tell you this, you don't want anybody to know it. So my friends never knew I had it. I did everything. Normally, I was a gymnast. I traveled, in fact, I went to Nationals twice. I traveled all the time doing gymnastics. I was, went to, the regionals and national meets. And so I was in, just horrible shape mentally, but no one knew it. No one knew it. And so if you can think about that for a little bit, if I'm doing that, even at school, that means that I know how to appear normal. In fact, maybe even enjoy myself for a little bit, depends on the activity. But in my mind, I'm not like that. Okay, so one of the things they say about alcoholics is they're like ducks. They look beautiful on the top of the water and relaxed, but under the water, they are working their ass off. And that's what it was. And being able to be in a situation and act like I was normal and like everybody else, regardless of what was going on in my head, became something that I became good at. Now, I'll tell you this, I'm going to move right into things, not really doing the background anymore, but I'm just going to go right into some of the things that came up. My older brother I loved very much and looked up to him, and just like a lot of people, I wanted to do whatever he was doing, and he started to get into marijuana, and which I could not do. I tried it, but I could not do it because it would definitely give me panic attacks, okay? But he drank too, and so I tried it a couple times and really didn't drink enough to have the effect. And I'll never forget this. My best friend, who lived behind me, we were able to get a six-pack of Milwaukee's Best, I think it was, from his dad, okay? And we kind of hit it out for a couple days, and then finally we sat down and drank it, three beers each. And the feeling that I had, I think I was 14 or 15, we drank them quick too. The feeling I had was as if, here's what I said to him. I said, this is how normal people feel. I don't know how that came out or where I got that from, but I felt like that. I felt like I was connected in a way I'd never been connected, and they're just normal ways, like where I was thinking about other people. I was thinking about the possibilities of life. I was thinking about how I had some courage and I was going to be able to do these things. And it would just felt like before I had that drink, I really felt like I was here and my spirit was ripped out of my body and lived a little bit to the right of where I was. And everything was painful. Everything was painful. And when I got that buzz, it was as if it was then hand in glove. I just felt, they call it, in doctor's opinion, ease and comfort. I guess it is like that, but I felt like my spirit got right, okay? And I did not, like, immediately drink all the time and try to recapture that feeling. It wasn't like that at all. But here's what else faded away. I could not feel fear like I did. And I drank some more, that year for sure. And the thing was, is that it erased the fear, that the anxiety, absolutely, it just took it away. So I thought in my mind, if the stuff really gets down, I always said to myself, if stuff really gets bad, I'll just go to the hospital and get put in a padded room and I'll at least be safe. All right, well, that got displaced by, I'm just going to get myself some beer and I'll be fine. I can take the edge off and I can survive. Okay, so that's, you can see how that can set up perfectly. But what's interesting is I didn't really like the fallout from drinking the next day. And I didn't like, I liked to surf every day. I grew up surfing and I surfed every day. I never drank when I wanted to surf. Drinking was at night. Drinking was with friends. Later on, drinking was at night by myself. I enjoyed that very much. Okay, it was not something I did during the day because it would mess up stuff I wanted to do. All right, so that's kind of how I was rolling along. I was in high school. I had wonderful friends, wonderful relationships. Alcohol never really took all of the fear away. As a matter of fact, I could really be in an anxious situation in the mornings after. And all of these things just felt like, I knew I wasn't normal, but I knew I was acting normal. I remember Billy Crystal said in a Saturday Night Live skit, he said, it's better to look good than to feel good, you know? And if you can't feel good, for right then, you can look good. Okay, but with alcohol, I can feel good later on when I want to and when I need to. And that was a powerful thing. I'm going to talk a little more about the feelings that it gave me and what happened because of it. I want to make sure we're okay on time. Is that one of the things is I got into a relationship that was pretty serious when I was in the 11th grade. I guess you're maybe 17 years old, and fell in love with this girl, and she was pretty amazing, and there was some drinking, but not a lot, but really went head over heels, and we had a really intense two-year relationship. And I remember in the second year that we were going out, I drove, and she lived in Sandbridge, which is a beach that's about 30 minutes through the rural roads from where I live. And what I did in that second year was I would buy a six pack and I would drink it between the 30 minutes between my house and her house. And I would have fireballs or some sort of breath mints. And I super enjoyed my ride there. I had the music on. I knew exactly where I needed to drink a beer at each juncture in order to have six done by the time I got there. And it was like, it only happened on Friday and Saturday nights. And so it was just, I could look forward to it all week. And what did I look forward to? Maybe going out with her? Yeah, I might have gotten, had sex later on and all that stuff. But I look forward to relaxing and being with myself in my car that I bought, with my paper route money at first. But, I enjoyed that. And the other thing that was kind of weird is I remember enjoying talking to her parents and they didn't know I was buzzed. That really got me off for some reason. So I could control my buzz. We always tried to do that growing up. We call it buzz management or whatever. But anybody that drank and then made an ass of themselves weren't hanging out with us because he couldn't handle it or whatever. I remember that being a big deal. So you can see alcohol is starting to have a kind of a weird place in my life. I was still spiritual. I was still doing a lot of the things that I guess someone that is a very sensitive person, anybody that has anxiety disorder, I can talk to and relate to. They come in the rooms all the time. And that's because they're very much living in a spiritual realm. Okay? And I think spiritual is anything that's invisible that you feel. Music can be spiritual. Love for another person can be spiritual. It's all invisible. Most of the things that I think about, if you talk about, my brother right now, I haven't seen him in maybe 9 months, but I feel like he's right there. That's spiritual in a way. And that's really what people that have drinking problems and anxiety disorders, they are living in that place where they don't feel normal necessarily. They are controlled by a world that maybe doesn't understand them, but they just need peace. They just need to get with people or to get with a substance that can give them peace. And so that's really what I was all about. And I see people come in all the time that are in that situation. I'll give you some real quick background again. I got married. I've had three wonderful children that started out, when I was 20, we had my daughter. And what was happening is I was at ODU and I was in college, and my wife got pregnant and we got married. That was just kind of what we decided to do. And I was still going to school. I had a contracting business I had started, and I was working down in Sandbridge. And I went to school at night after we got married, and when I got out of school, I went to work for AT&T, and my my then wife's dad worked at, he was an executive at AT&T, so I really got a good start, and that was really, you know, right when I got married. I was drinking, but it was just weekends. And first daughter, it was wonderful. A lot of great things were going on. I really started to do well at AT&T. I did enjoy the, we were always on the road. I was always with customers, and you know, we were always at bars. My boss, I remember, he's from Philadelphia. He drank seven shots of Stoli's a night, and before he even talked to, you know, the salespeople and so forth. So it's just, it was just worked right into everything I did. And there were many bars and a lot of the places we'd stay. And of course, I remember, you know, meetings, seminars by day, but everybody would meet back in the bar. And I enjoyed that lifestyle. I got right into it. And I had two more sons, and all was well. And I won't go into it too much, but my children's mother was caught next door by my daughter with the next door neighbor, and they had three kids, and they were so they were caught in the act, okay, without going into too much more detail. That was devastating for me. I ended up going into a clinical depression because of it, not being able to work for about 3 months. And that was something I'd never experienced. I stopped drinking because I just felt like if I drank at that point, it would be like pouring kerosene on a fire. So I am in a clinical depression. I don't even, it has put me way beyond being upset or angry. That's kind of gone to the wayside. I'm just trying to survive, maybe. And what's interesting is I didn't drink for a year, but I came out of that depression, and for the second half of that year, I was probably my most productive I've ever been. I was having a spiritual awakening coming out of that depression, and it was wonderful. And I remember I had a girl, new girlfriend after about 6 months of, after I got divorced, and she said, she didn't really know that I had a drinking problem. I didn't know it either. But she said, hey, listen, I booked a bed and breakfast in Charleston, and it's in about 3 months, and we can just go down there, relax, both have a glass of wine, and it's going to be great. All right, as soon as she said that, I went, damn, that sounds great. All right, so the next day I'm on my way home from work, have a rough day, and on the way home I'm going, man, I'm going on vacation. I'm going to have that glass of wine in 3 months. And I just felt good about that. All right, every night on my way home, I couldn't wait to get in the car to think about it. Not to have it, to think about it. I was thinking about it the whole way home. That glass, I mean, the glass, it was red wine, or it was Chardonnay, or it was this. And I had the restaurant pictured. And by the time it came up to go, 2 weeks before we got there, if someone from the future would have come back and said, Thomas, don't drink. Don't drink. Don't do it. Wild horses couldn't keep me away. It was a planted thought in my mind. Also, what I would tell you is you can't take my dream away. Are you kidding me? That's what I live for. It happened then. Of course it happened exactly like I thought. I'll never forget it because I got so drunk that night, I remember taking my glasses off and putting them on the bedside table where there was a candle. It went right to the candle, and my glasses were not metal. They were plastic somewhere, and they caught on fire. And that was just the beginning. So I go off. Now I'm drinking. Now I have a drinking problem because I'm dealing with the divorce. I'm dealing with a new girlfriend. I'm dealing with all the stuff. I need to drink. And I did drink, and I didn't really have any problems until maybe 2 or 3 years later. And here's what was happening 2 or 3 years later. I am working in Suffolk. I work for Charter Communications down here. And about an hour drive, and I am getting up in the morning, I have custody of my kids, getting my sons off to school, and having suicidal hangovers every single morning. And I'm going to work, I'm working hard. Everybody around lunchtime starts talking about what they're gonna be eating. I'm not doing any of that, okay? Because I never ate lunch. I wanted my stomach pristine, so that when I drank the alcohol, it could have full effect. I was a martyr. They called me a workaholic at work, okay? And then about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, I started to get a little excited feeling in my chest, as if I was a 5-year-old before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, you know, life is okay. I'm doing good at work. You know, I just need to relax. And I had, for the next 2 hours, just this great feeling. And the hope, it just kept building and building. And then I would go into the same exact place on and buy a 12-pack. And the lady in there thought I was just the happiest person she's ever met, because she met me for the best 5 minutes of my day. On the way to the car, I could feel my feeling as if I'd already drank, because my blood was going down to my toes and coming up to my head, and I could not wait to get in the truck. So I would drink that 12-pack all the way to pick up the boys, and you can see how that's a little bit like the girl, okay, with the 6-pack. But now I'm picking the boys up, and then when I get them home, I am feeding them quickly. Okay, stuff I've had already prepared, and they're going to bed at 9 and 10 years old at 8:30. They're going to bed, and I'm dressing them in what they're going to wear the next day, including their shoes. They don't have shoelaces like normal people. They have shoelaces that have been permanently tied with hot glue, because I got sick of shoelaces being untied. Okay, so they're in bed so that I can wake them up the next morning and get them to school with the minimum effort. I go, when they go to bed, I go right to the freezer where there's a freezing handle of Absolut, and I drink until 1 o'clock in the morning, and then I go to my closet, get a whole bottle of NyQuil, open it up, drink it down without the whole thing. Go lay in my bed and let the blackness come in. Wake up the next morning, suicidal hangover. Repeated. And I'm a shell of a person. And what happened to me was I could not stop that. Nothing could happen bad enough to make me want to do something different, except for I was separated from alcohol by 2 different police departments. In 6 weeks, I got 2 DUIs. The final one was in Gloucester, Virginia, and I was actually relieved to see that blue light behind me, because I needed something from the outside to stop me. It wasn't my ideal, but I wanted to do something different, anything. And I was suicidal. I just wanted to slow down enough so I could get up enough courage to kill myself. I couldn't do that. So that's a weird, bad place to be in. By the way, how much time do we have?
15 minutes.
Okay. So I am in Gloucester Jail, all right? And what I have is I am in, I'm on a concrete bed, and I have my tickets they gave me. There's like all of them are carbon tickets. I don't have a pen, but I want to write I'm sorry notes to my sons. I don't have a pen, so what I'm doing is I'm taking my thumbnail and I'm pushing on the carbon so it'll write. And I write out probably a 80-word letter to them, both. And I'm sitting in there and I'm waiting to get bond, to find out if I'm going to get a bond or not. And then my idea is to get out of there and drive into a tree. And as I'm sitting in there, though, I'm thinking, what would it be if I did something different? And I don't know how it came to me, but I remembered my brother is, what's that club my brother's in? He's in a club about not drinking. What's that club? And then it came to my mind that he was in AA. And that's why I want anybody to know, if you're in AA and you're doing well, and you're the only one in your whole family or all your friends that's sober, that is an important position. Because what will happen is your friends or someone fairly distant will be in a situation like that, and it will come to them like a spark or a bolt. Hey, I know that one guy that's in that drinking club that knows how to not drink. It will happen so that they will think you're might be the only person they know that they can call that might understand. So it's so important for me to be that person for other people. The fact that my brother was in the program and that he was not drinking, I don't know if I'd be here if that didn't come into my mind. So that was very important. And I got out of there and I called him. And he said, I knew you would be getting ready soon. And he said, go right to a meeting. I don't care what you have to do. You need to get there now. And we had a family friend that was in the program. And she was from church. Her name was Karen Bell. She's still alive, but she's probably 90. She took me to my first meeting 2 hours after getting out of Gloucester jail. I go to this meeting, and it is at the side door. A guy named Ralph, who's passed away, was leading the meeting. He was very famous. And so I go to this meeting with her, and I remember when they described the burning desire, I talked at that point, and it sounded to me like the Charlie Brown teacher voice. I was talking, but I couldn't hear myself talk really. But they did. I saw the most loving eyes. It was about as many people as are in here, but there was women too. And they were looking at me, and they were had the most loving eyes while I was talking. And I really didn't know what I said, but it came from deep down. And the meeting was over, and I experienced what we call the AA donut. That's where the people that are there that know what this way of life is and what it can mean to save someone surrounded me. And I remember a guy named JC, he's passed also, but he goes, you're just like me, you're gonna be okay, you're just like me. And he ended up being a very important person in my recovery. And I'll tell you right now, I got a white chip. I'll tell you right now, I became close friends with everyone that was in that room. And those people, here's what's interesting is it was a midday meeting, and many of the people don't ever really go to that meeting except for maybe two or three times a year. It just happened that they were there or something. And I would go if, like, Chuck knows AA in this area from back then, I could go through the list of people that were at that meeting and he would know every one of them. And those people became my people. And here's what happened to me. I lost everything. I moved my kids out of the big five-bedroom house back into my parents' house at age 38. Had no job, and my industry was toast, too. Okay, I burned that bridge like you can't believe. And so I didn't, I said, man, let me go into teaching. Well, that took 2 years to do, okay, but I was in AA. Right then, though, I didn't know what the heck was going on after that first meeting. All I knew is I had a panic anxiety disorder without alcohol, and I was going to be doing some jail time, and I was claustrophobic. And I remember asking my sponsor, I said, do they have a different jail for people that are claustrophobic? He goes, yeah, they do. He goes, it's just like jail. It's the same jail that they all go to. And I said, yeah, right, very funny. And what I did is my sponsor was a wonderful low-bottom drunk who got sober. He loved alcoholics. He believed in every aspect of the miraculous part of this program. I went with him to 11 meetings. He picked me up. We both smoked. He picked me up in his Crown Vic that had a, the hood on it was, you could play tennis on it. And he drove it with one finger, and we went to 11 meetings a week. And it was, I didn't know what to do except get dressed and be out. He didn't want me to be late getting out to the curb. I had to be on the curb when he showed up. And I wouldn't get dropped off until later that night. But we went to meeting after meeting. I was just talking earlier, he was my sponsor, my grand sponsor, his name was Joe Klonch, okay, he got sober in 1976, I think, that was Chuck's sponsor also, he's still alive, but then his sponsor was Ray Chambers, who got sober in 1946, met Bill W., and he drove into a paddy wagon in 1946 on Granby Street and was arrested. That was his last drunk. And anyway, I'm going to the VA hospital with all three of them, maybe 6 months into the program. And my sponsor's name was Marble. And he said, oh, great speaker tonight at the VA. I said, really, who? He goes, you. So as soon as we got there, I went and called my brother. He said, look, do an experiment. Go and don't think about what you're going to say. Don't think about anything. And you're going to go to the bathroom and you're going to get on your knees and ask God to give you the words. And don't do any prep. And just don't do anything until you get up there in front of everybody. And I thought I was going to have a panic attack. I didn't want to do that, but I listened. And I did that. And oh my gosh, it was like the Charlie Brown teacher voice, but I could hear myself, and I was just going through my story, and it was coming out, and I just couldn't believe it. Who's talking right now? And now, what is happening is, I love that stuff. That's like my great-grandmother's. That's like my grandfather that told me how it was on Iwo Jima. You know, he gave me all the things he did in the war, and I loved every bit of it. And that's what AA was. That's what I love AA history, because my sponsor loved it. And we went and traveled around everywhere searching out places that we could find out about AA history. So it was beautiful. And but here's what happened. At 8 months in, I had a depression and went into it. And it wasn't for no other reason, but AA was so much in my person. But it was devastating, this depression. And I remember the only thing I could do, didn't sleep for 6 nights, the only thing I could do was walk around the big neighborhood. And that was the only time I could even be in my own skin. And I had to do that all the time. And I was going around, and then finally it was 3 a.m. one time, and I said, God, I have to cut this pain. I can't take it. I have to cut it. And I was going to go to a 7-Eleven and burst through the window. and get that alcohol that I knew in my back pocket, a trump card, I knew the alcohol would take that away. And then I would ask for help. And then I remember, and I said, any length, I'll go to any length. And I'll never forget that, because what my plan was, I'm going to go to the police station. Someone had told me, if you ever want 90 days of free sobriety, just go punch a cop. They were joking, but I was like at that place. When that happened, it felt like my back broke. And I go, oh my God. And I went home and I went to sleep like a baby. I woke up an hour later, and for the next 2.5 days, I had a spiritual experience, which I can't go into now, but it was remarkable. I would, and especially when I was in meetings, just remarkable. Maybe one day I'll come back and tell you what happened, because I think it's just amazing. And I haven't had a panic attack since. Not one. I'll tell you this, what it felt like was I could immediately see even objects that were given as a present. I could see the love around an object that I had a memory of, but especially people sharing, they had halos almost around it, or lights, and I could feel what was happening at a very spiritual level. Okay, and there's a lot more to it. I wrote it down. My sponsor knew I was having it, but it was remarkable. And that has been wonderful, but that went away, that mountaintop experience. But what has never gone away is, and anybody that's in here that knows me, I always feel better after a meeting, period. My ducks mentally get in a row. I got crazy stuff going on throughout the day, but when I get to my meeting, how it works is read, and I am able to spiritually be there with everybody. And I go to the morning meetings. I don't know how my car gets there, but I go to meetings in the morning and at night. I don't even think I'm doing it. Doesn't ever get in the way of anything. I don't know how that works. Coming here, doing all the, I don't know how I got here, okay? But anytime I'm going to a meeting, I don't even think about it. It just happens. If you've ever experienced that, you know what I'm talking about. That's living in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I've had times where I'm not doing that. That's the spirituality of the program. The last thing I want to say is Bill W. knew that. Okay, and a number of other people knew that. But if you read Bill's story, at the very end it says, I didn't find work for a couple of years, and I was plagued by self-pity and doubt. And in despair, driven almost to drink, I would go to my old hospital, and when talking with a patient there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. And that is it. I know that. I trust that. I think anybody that can trust that will have that experience. It is remarkable, and I would never have connected with that if I had not been to that midnight of the soul. So when others are coming in, I love to hear them with my spirit when they come in. They're coming in all the time at our group, and I can't wait to see them, because I know that, and I can't wait to see them have a spiritual experience. And it happens. It's just, I love this program. I hope I always do, but I do know if I go to my meeting and get with my people, I will be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It's never failed me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas, for sharing your story. Had a great story about New Day. I can remember going out there. It was probably 6 months into sobriety for me. Finally ventured out and going to some meetings. My sponsor told me, make sure you're shaking everybody's hand. There's the meeting before the meeting. There's the meeting after the meeting. Make sure you're introducing yourself. It's a fellowship thing. At the time, I didn't understand because I still didn't like people very much. But the great thing about New Day is it sits just like Thomas described it. There's a bar on the left, church on the right, and there's New Day. And none of them show up 30 minutes before the freaking meeting, which is so great. So I walked up to this meeting and I see standing out front, there's probably 15 people smoking cigarettes. And I'm thinking, shit, say, hey, me. So I walk up, promptly introduce myself, shaking everyone's hand, till the guy from New Day showed up, opened the door, not a single one of the people, they were all from the bar drinking. Thomas, thank you, because you're right. This way of life is that rising tide and that hard way of living, right? These are the things that get us through. So thank you very much for sharing your story. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers donations to the church and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and General Services Office. And I should follow that up about New Day. It's a great meeting. If you haven't gotten out and poked your nose over there, you should really go out and go visit them. It's a fantastic meeting. Are there any AA-related announcements? I have one. There are flyers on the table. Please take them with you when you leave. Please pass them out in your home group. Into Action Group. This group presents its first annual gratitude dinner. Shonda G, Carlos R, and Shelly H will be sitting on a panel. We'll be talking and sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Friday night, November the 14th. Dinner will be served at 6:30. Workshop will begin at 7:30 with an Ask It Basket. It'll be right here in this very room. If you've never attended one of Into Action's dinner meetings, I strongly encourage you to come out, because I can't ever tell you how many people are going to be here, but I can guarantee you won't walk out of here hungry. Are there any other AA-related announcements?
Thomas Alcoholic.
Hey, Thomas.
Strategy Breakfast is November 8th. It is in Virginia Beach at Bayside Presbyterian, and it is at 9 o'clock, and they're going to have eggs and sausage and all that good stuff, and that was good there before 9. I've gotten there right at 9, I thought. So definitely come early. And three speakers, one from each district, is going to be wonderful.
Thank you.